today on The Grave Talks, is there any scientific proof of ghosts or the afterlife? The existence of ghosts is a real phenomenon. Scientific research, historical evidence, and firsthand accounts prove that our souls are consciousness with or without the physical body. In the documentary, Ghosts and the Afterlife, a Scientific Investigation, they look into what happens after we die and how ghosts could actually exist. I'm Carol Hughes, filling in for Tony Bruschi, and joining us today on The Grave Talks is the director of Ghosts in the Afterlife, Steve Sayer, and Kelsey Bolin, who is the film's narrator. And Steve, let's start with you first. What was behind you getting involved in doing this film?
Well, actually, it was my brother, Garrett, who decided this topic was of tremendous interest to many people, including himself, because it's such a subject of uncertainty amongst so many people. A lot of people think it was inspired by the fact that I had died twice on the operating room table, and I had a near-death experience after a 55-mile-an-hour head-on collision, but it actually wasn't. I happen to have experienced those events, although it was Garrett who insisted on pursuing this topic just as a matter of scientific and also spiritual interest.
Okay, so you cannot throw out died twice on the operating room table and not me circle back to that right away. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes. The injury, the initial injury occurred in the military. I was in Army intelligence and the assignment didn't go as anticipated. And then later after the injury, the injuries became more and more profound. And subsequently, I was having coronary exploratory surgery and three arteries dissected spontaneously, according to the physicians, the cardiologist and the open heart surgeon. At that point, very shortly thereafter, I flatlined. And they tried to bring me back for quite some time. And due to the fact that the nurses were hysterical, according to one of the other nurses I spoke to afterward, and one was so confused because no one expected this, that she forgot to gel the paddles before she gave them to the physician, and she burned the skin off my chest in the attempt to bring me back. But ultimately, that was the least of my problems, obviously, but it was an interesting side story. But after I died the first time, and it was for an extended period of time, they had a lot of difficulty bringing me back because there was such massive injury at that stage in the heart. And it took, according to the nurses that I'd spoken to when I was in the ICU subsequent to my surgery, it was about 10 to 15 minutes that I was clinically dead before they ultimately brought me back the first time. The entire room just seemed to go into a different dimension where it was filled with a sense of well-being and that everything would be all right, in which I wasn't even thinking one way or the other. I was just facing the physical realities before my clinical death and dealing with that. And then there was a voice that said, "Don't worry, you're going home," which really confused me a great deal because I didn't consider anywhere home. All my life, I traveled from one state and one country to another, due to the fact that my family traveled ever since I was 2.5 years old. My family was traveling from one state or one country to the other. So the idea of home wasn't any religious or spiritual association I had in my subconscious. It was something completely outside my thought process at the time. So I was confused by that. I wasn't stressed by it. I was just thinking, well, where's home? Then subsequently, they finally brought me back, and then I flatlined the second time. And the second time was virtually identical. There was this sense of well-being. Everything was fine. I was in an alternate dimension other than the dimension that we're currently living in. And then the same voice with a slightly different intonation, but still very calm and collected, said again, "Don't worry, you're going home." And again, I was very confused because I wondered where home might be. And then I started to see a light. But then they started to administer general anesthesia, and that's when everything went black. In other words, it was no longer, once they put me under anesthesia, I wasn't having an experience at that point as far as extra paranormal activity that you might consider having in those circumstances, because the anesthesia brought me out of that sense of well-being into a sense of almost nothingness, although I did wake up in the middle of the operation. So then I was physically awake and I could see my reflection in the large overhead lamp that they use because they have that mirror reflection. So I could see my chest flayed open and the operation proceeding. And that went on for an extended period of time, probably a good 45 minutes to an hour. Of course, as you imagine, it was psychologically tormenting to see the whole process and not even being able to speak, although I tried to speak. At one point, at about the 45-minute or an hour period, it was I must have made some grumblings through the, you know, because you're on life support while they're doing the surgery and they have your, the heart is being pumped by an artificial heart, the lungs are being pumped by a ventilator. So you can't really speak, but I evidently made a groaning or growling noise or whatever. And they said, "Oh my God, he's awake." And then they way overdosed me with anesthesia. And that was a whole nother story. But that's the basic story in a nutshell.
I have to say that is one of my biggest fears, is waking up on an operating table. We're also joined by Kelsey Boland. Now, you narrated the film, and the fact, Kelsey, that you're joining us today makes me think that this was more than just a job for you, that this is also an interest and something, you know, you're like me maybe, or maybe you have some personal experiences with near-death experiences or spirits or both. How did you become involved with the film?
I essentially just auditioned whenever I lived in LA. Okay. And I read the script and then I auditioned for it and I thought it went well. But, you know, there are hundreds of auditions and actors there every day. So you just never know what jobs you're going to book. And then I booked this job and it was fascinating. It just went on for months and we traveled all over interviewing psychic mediums and doing ghost hunts, and I don't have any personal near-death experiences, but I have seen spirits.
Well, in fact, and we've got two parts, and we're doing, and the second part will be ghosts, but you were out in a field where you were doing an investigation, and you saw something there.
I did, and I was the only one who did, so I don't know, I can't explain it, but I'm a major empath, so I've always felt a lot more than the average person. So it's not surprising to me. But as the filming went on, I developed a major interest in the near-death and after-death experiences just by the people who experienced it firsthand, who I interviewed.
I think it's very fascinating, too, when you talk to someone like Steve who has had an experience like that. And especially with you, you took a deep dive and talked to a lot of people. It really does change how you look at it. And you see, you know, these are normal people. They are perfectly fine. They're not, you know, there's no issues mentally with these people. And they had these incredible experiences. And I think it kind of changes how you look at life, maybe, that there's more to it that we don't know.
Oh, most definitely. As the filming went on, I mean, I just gained so much knowledge, and it's almost kind of calming just to even talk to these people who are, like you said, ordinary everyday people, no mental health problems.
Right.
And just to hear these firsthand accounts makes you kind of look at the world through a different lens.
Now, I do think it's interesting with this film that you don't just talk to people who have had near-death experiences, but the accounts that you share in the film are absolutely fascinating to me, the people that you talk to. You also talk to, because there is a scientific element of this documentary, so you also talk to doctors. And Steve, you want to talk a little bit about some of the findings that people have when it comes to near-death experience, life after death, some of their take on it?
Well, scientifically speaking, the scientific investigations in the film, there's one where the discussion revolves around a centrifuge where they have the jet pilots lose consciousness, where the centrifuge is going so quickly that literally they lose all the blood supply to their brain. So there's no longer any physical capacity for them to be conscious. It should be total darkness, and they should be completely unaware of their existence, at least from a physiological perspective. However, during that experiment, and they did it with several different jet pilots, the consciousness that the pilots experienced after losing all physical consciousness from a blood supply perspective, they all recounted having a greater sense of consciousness than they ever had before during the physical unconsciousness. So that's one scientific study that shows that consciousness can exist in opposition to our current understanding of physical science. There's also another study that was done by the government, and it was called Stargate Program, where they were investigating consciousness that could take place over thousands of miles. So if someone was sitting in an office and asked to think about a particular location, that they could extend that consciousness to that location and gather intelligence data, which was the interest of the military in this particular program. And that's referred to as remote viewing. But then again, that scientifically proves that consciousness can be extended without a physical form, because obviously our consciousness mm-hmm. as physical human beings is limited to our surrounding environment, at least according to the physical laws that we understand. However, those experiments prove that the consciousness can extend by itself over many thousands of miles. Then there's many other studies scientifically, like there's a scientific expose on how they created invisibility, which you saw in the documentary. And most people have never heard of that yet. It's been done twice at two different university programs. And then, of course, the ghost that Kelsey was speaking of, that she saw, nobody else saw it but her at the time. And the only time I saw it was in post-production. Because I just thought, well, she's a little animal, a rabbit jumped out and she saw some bushes move. You know, it would be common for somebody to say, what's that? And that's what I assumed it was when we're actually filming. But in post-production, then I saw what looked like similar to the Predator in the movie The Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where the body is moving, but it's completely transparent. And you see the bushes and the weeds behind the body, but it was like a full form of like a teenage boy, probably, and you know, or someone in their early 20s. It was an image of the person that we were looking for, because somebody had been murdered in that area, and it was the same image. It was a high school track star, so the image fit his anthropomorphic configuration. Although it was a transparent image, which you saw in the mm-hmm. documentary. And then I, you know, also, as you mentioned, there's none of the experts in the film aren't either extraordinarily ensconced in the subject matter, like the Stargate program was handled by a military captain. He was in charge of the program. And then all the other experts are PhDs in their respective studies, and many of them, and the majority of them, have medical doctorates. and they speak from their experiences with their patients and other experiences that are relevant to that, that they've investigated on their own. And of course, the whole program goes to one piece of evidence after another. It's interesting to me that some people from some of the reviews that I see are kind of blindsided, and they insist that there's no scientific evidence presented in the film. I have no idea what film they watched when I read their review, because that's what it is all the way through. Of course, we also present the historical aspects of the potential for the afterlife, as well as various different religious perspectives. But then you'll see some reviews saying, why didn't they discuss the religious perspectives? So you, again, sometimes there's people that are making comments that obviously have not seen the film. It's very bizarre. Why they're bothering to write these reviews exactly when they haven't watched it is curious to me.
I have found out a long time ago, just don't read the reviews. It's just,
yeah,
I agree. You can't make sense of them, right?
Oh, some of them are just bizarre.
And some of them are brutal, and some of them just, you know, some of them are nice. That's the ones you want to read. But then I think people write stuff forgetting they're actual people that are actually going to read these comments and would like to know, and that was just mean. But
yeah, some of them may be done out of spite. You never know. You don't know what they're always kind of non-compos mentis. They make bizarre comments. Like a lot of them said they didn't like the color of Kelsey's dress. It's like, how does that have any relevance?
It's not about her dress. In fact, I thought you had an adorable dress on, Kelsey.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that you talk about is you talked about energy in the program. And years ago, my father's girlfriend died, and he was really, really, really distraught. Now, my dad had a very interesting life himself, and he'd had some spiritual encounters with things that he couldn't explain. And we did live in a haunted house for quite a while when I was a kid. But he went on to become a mortician of all things. And so he really thought about life and death a lot, obviously, as a mortician. After his girlfriend died, I remember having a conversation with him, and he was so upset. It was breaking my heart. And he said, you know, but when you die, you can't kill energy. There's an energy that keeps you going, and you can't kill that. And I think that's so true that, like, so people who just think when you die, game over, you know, it doesn't make any sense of why we're here, why we're talking right now, you know, what are we doing right now? But I always thought that was an interesting take on the energy. Do you have a comment on that?
Well, energy, from our knowledge of physics in this dimension, as your father said, even an understanding of physics from the physical dimension, energy cannot be destroyed. Energy just converts to a different form. And that's a universally accepted law of physics. And I'm sure that the same is true when we investigate consciousness. I also tell people that, you know, we separate physical from spiritual, but in reality, everything's going to have some physical properties, even if it's entirely different from the physical properties we understand here on Earth. And it may be entirely different as far as the properties of a dimension that's an alternate dimension on Earth that we don't currently acknowledge because we're not capable of seeing or understanding it at this stage.
Mm-hmm. I agreed. I agree with that. Now, Kelsey, you obviously talked to a lot of people during this film. Now, when it came to some of the people talking about their near-death experiences, were there any that really, really touched you and moved you? I would imagine they all did, because there were some really fascinating stories.
They did. They all moved me in different ways. But there was a young lady who was describing a car crash that she was in when she was really young, and how she, you know, floated above her body in the hospital. And that was just really, really an experience to listen to her and hear her firsthand account.
I agree with that. And You know, so many people talk about that kind of floating above their body and seeing it like they're someone else watching that. I just think that's so fascinating to me that so many people have had a similar experience like that.
I agree. Yeah, it is. It's crazy. I mean, it can't be some made up thing, or else multiple people wouldn't have experienced the same thing. And it's amazing because it really is your consciousness leaving your actual physical body. And I also found it fascinating that none of them really experienced any kind of fear. So I found that fact interesting as well.
Steve, you are a perfect example of that when you said, you know, that you're home, but you weren't afraid, were you?
No, not at all. Yeah, it was a very, I'm trying to think of the right word, but it was, I was very calm and felt an extreme sense of well-being is the best way for me to explain it.
Now, a lot of people, when they go through a near-death experience, you hear about that, their life flashed before their eyes, which is interesting, a life flashing before your eyes, because yeah. You've lived this whole full life that how it flashes before your eyes. What are some of the findings, some of the takes on that?
Well, I had an experience where my life flashed before my eyes, separate from the one that I mentioned in the hospital from the military injury, which was a 55 mile an hour head-on collision. And in that fraction of a second before the collision, literally all the most important events of my life and people that I'd known and everything that I'd done that was at all significant, literally in that one fraction of a second, really spun through my mind. But it wasn't as if it was rushed. And it was just literally in probably a half second, three quarters of a second. But I knew in my mind, I was certain that there was no way I was going to survive the collision. So I think that when somebody is absolutely certain they're going to die, that may trigger that event. And that event may be either for the sake of uploading information for what we historically have referred to as the judgment of our life, or it could be information's being uploaded into an alternate dimension that we're going to be moving toward after our physical death on this planet, or possibly both.
Now, you might think I'm crazy, but I've never experienced anything like that. I've obviously thought about it. But do you think it's also kind of the review, like you finished the test and here's what you did, you know, kind of here's how you did in class, sort of the review of your life, you know, because I always feel like we must be here for a reason. There has to be some hurdles that are thrown in front of us that, you know, we've all faced that, you know, how you get around that obstacle, how you deal with your life, really the lessons you learn. Basically. So kind of like this is a classroom. I don't know. Maybe that's kind of crazy, but here's what you did. Laid out in front of you.
Well, that's historically how they always really present it. And in the Bible, they present it as you present your life is reviewed by at the pearly gates and they decide where you're going. Right. So you're going one place or another. You know, often when you think back on new scientific developments and the historical facts documented in the Bible and other historical texts, you realize that they were accurate when we have certain watershed scientific discoveries. And you realize, yeah, that's it. Or we have findings that support other information that's been recorded historically. Because the Bible, a lot of people don't realize, is a history book that was compiled from many, many different authors. A lot of people don't realize that, but that's what it is, and that's what it was intended to be.
And you kind of get into that, you do get into that in the film about religion. You know how some religions embrace kind of a life after death experience, some don't. And in a I think it's Catholicism, basically, that you're talking about in the movie. But, you know, back in the day, Catholicism was pretty much the only game when it came to religion, you know, in a lot of the world, I should say. But, you know, because they really did kind of affect how people thought, you know, any religion does. And so it just makes me, you know, wonder, you know, what you're exposed to as a child kind of is how you think about life after death, you know, how you're brought up.
And yeah, it certainly has a significant impact. I as a child was, I don't think there was much discussion of it whatsoever, actually. But the impact of religion or any type of teaching in childhood is very profound. It can be used for either extremely positive things or extremely evil things, you know, to train people to kill other people because they don't believe in your particular religion. And I think we all know a religion that reflects that. The people's minds can be profoundly shaped in either the right or the wrong direction as a child.
Now, I'm going to ask this question of you, Steve, in just a second. I'll ask Kelsey first, because you talked to a lot of people who had near-death experiences. Did you find that it changed their outlook on life? Did it affect kind of who they were? Did they see the world differently after that happened to them? Did you have that conversation with anyone?
Yeah, they did. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you want me to answer?
I'll go Kelsey and then Steve, because I would like that, because you experienced it personally. And so we'll start with Kelsey.
Sure. So yes, Sam, I did find that. They all seem to have, I'm trying to think of the word that best describes it or is most applicable, but they all seem to just have a more ethereal view of the world. And like, this is just kind of a piece of the pie.
Did you encounter anyone who felt like, because I've heard this too, their work isn't done, so they needed to come back?
Yes, ma'am. Almost all of them.
I think that's fascinating. Steve, how did you feel after your experiences? Which is, I might add, very unusual for you to have had this happen more than once.
Yeah, well, it was the incident. It was such a long, long extended recovery, because after, as I mentioned, I woke up and then they overdosed me with the anesthesia because they thought I was resistant, obviously, because I woke up, and they didn't assume that that would happen. But then when I initially woke up from the anesthesia, I was still on life support, but I couldn't really hear and I couldn't really see. All I could see was blurs, and all I could hear was tin, tin, kind of these pin noises. But I could see that there were people moving around. But it took me a long time, because it took, I don't know, probably they had me on life support for a couple of days from what I recall. And I kept writing notes. I was able to write. When I finally got somebody to give me a notepad, I kept doing this little action to try to get them to give me a notepad, because I couldn't speak, because you're attached to a ventilator. So you can't, you're in the ICU on a ventilator. But it took so long, I think it might have mitigated to recover from that. It went on and on. Then they overdosed me with inadvertently, obviously, with 48 hours of antibiotics in 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And then I went into anaphylactic shock, and it started tearing the sutures in my heart. So I don't think I ever had the opportunity, like a lot of people do, to reflect on it in a less chaotic way. Because I also thought very clearly, what would I do if I were in a situation where I was dying, what the experience would be, what I would do or what I wouldn't do. So I'd already thought of it, because in the military, you think about that all the time when you're in certain circumstances. So I don't think I didn't have that any type of an epiphany beyond the epiphanies I'd already had before the incident took place.
I just think it's so unusual, like, that you went through this more than once, you're still here. It sounds cliche, but there has to be a reason you're still here. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you have to have thought about that a few times. Like, how did I live through this?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's been quite a few incidents. The two primary incidents that we just covered. It's been a very it's been a chaotic life to this point. You know, what is it? The old saying, "Cursed is a man with an interesting life." But I don't see it as being cursed. I just know that's an old saying. Because it is difficult to go through these processes, but you certainly learn a great deal.
I think you do. I really do. Now, this wraps up part one of our conversation with Steve Sayer and Kelsey Bowen with Ghosts and the Afterlife. It is a documentary. Steve, where can you see it? I watched on Amazon.
Yes, you can watch on Amazon they're selling the DVD and the rental. The rental is very inexpensive. And then they have the download. Then there's Vudu, which I recommend if you don't have an Amazon account, because you just simply quickly rent it and it's done. With Amazon, is a more extended process involved. They're both terrific. If you have an Amazon account, that's the easiest place to rent it.
Super easy.
Yeah. And then there's Google Play and there's Vimeo, which is available worldwide. And some are available in different countries and others aren't, like iTunes, for instance, iTunes in the US and England and Australia. So it's all over the place. But Vimeo in the United States is everywhere, of course, as well as the rest of the world. So, but I would say Amazon, Vudu, Vimeo.
Now, tomorrow, I'm looking forward to this because we're going to be talking about ghosts tomorrow. So if you'd like to access all of our episodes, including the archive and advanced episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts and you can try it for 30 days absolutely free. You can also go to Patreon/TheGraveTalks and get everything there, all ad free. For all of us at The Grave Talks, I'm Carol Hughes, and thanks for listening.